From a dot in the middle of the map, this is Midwesternish. I'm Gina Kaufman. Every city still has that one bookstore. At least, I hope it does. The irreverent corner shop with creaky wood floors, scattered rugs, and precariously stacked reading material on the verge of toppling over. The place where literary types hang out and plot revolution. In Kansas City, that bookstore is Prospero's. Most days, you can find the owner behind the counter. His name is Will Leatham.
It's a curious place. I mean, you always look around trying to describe what it is you do. We're clearly a bookstore, but it's a little more than that. It's about the processing of information. However we do it, we take information in, we run it through the human rubric of our mind, and then we try and help it get back out. A lot of people have done it before us for millennia. We share some of their works, hopefully, for a small fee. music, poetry, and stuff like that. And, you know, a warehouse of the mind attracts people who are attracted to those things.
Will Leatham has flowing blonde hair that comes down to his shoulders. He leads what he calls a small life, walking to work, chatting up customers, and raising his son in the aisles of a bookstore. But Will's life didn't always look this way. He used to wear a suit back when he was a big-time political consultant for the Republican Party. Bet you weren't expecting that.
Just so you know, I had exact same pair of glasses.
Really?
Yep, and my hair was almost this long, though I wore it greased back.
On this episode, what the neighborhood book peddler learned from his background in conservative politics. Let's start at the beginning, or near the beginning, at a suburban Kansas City high school in the 1970s.
In high school, I was the guy with long hair, much longer than it is now, and I was one of the first guys to learn to play guitar in our crew of friends, and I listened to a lot of Led Zeppelin and Uriah Heep in the basement, and that was pretty much what I did.
This is a CBS News special report, Campaign 76. Tonight, the third session of the Republican National Convention from the Kemper Arena in Kansas City.
My father was a very active, big Republican. And the year that the Republican Convention came to Kansas City, which I think was 76, my dad took an active role. And he always ensured me, anytime we had a chance, he took me to go see the individuals personally, because you can learn a lot more 10 minutes with a person in a room than you can reading a biography on him. But he had been supporting Ronald Reagan. And then Ronald Reagan lost in that primary, and Dole ended up getting selected as the vice president in the whole scenario. And he flipped the thing. And my father, I remember him going to school, he put a button on me, and he goes, "We're now these kind of people, and we support this candidate." And I had to wear this button to school, and I didn't think
much
about
it. Wait, what did the button say?
It was whoever was the nominee then. I mean, it was Dole. Who did Dole run with? Ford. Ford and Dole. There it was. And it was a Ford-Dole button. And he says, "We now do this." And I... Before school, and you know, high school can be, and junior high can be a little rough sometimes to people who are not quite exactly like everybody else. And I was being given some grief by some people in a hallway about, you know, long hair, and you're for this, you know, you guys are really Democrats, blah, 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 blah. And, it came to, like, really intense, a couple of people giving me a lot of grief in front of, like, the hall just filled up with people.
And essentially for your family's...
Yeah, my dad's belief. I mean, I believed in Led Zeppelin. And they pushed me a little bit, and I wasn't very articulate at that point in my life. So I just punched the guy. And then the next week, I went down and I got a hold of the Dole campaign.
So you swung first.
I swung and read up on it later. I didn't know what to do. I mean, when you're so confronted and so outnumbered, it was a pugilistic intro to politics for a pugilistic sport, I guess. But then I went down and volunteered with the Dole people and was going door to door. And I mean, it never looked back after that.
There's a change that's come over America. Change that's great to see.
President Ford has restored my faith in the United States government.
Ford makes me feel like America's going in the right direction.
I'm feeling good about America.
And I encourage people to get involved, particularly when you're young. Find something you like and go volunteer. It turns into stuff, particularly because you'll catch the bug of being civically active and involved in politics is, you know, football for the intellect. It's sports. It's, I mean, the election part of it is. The governing part of it's a different mindset. But, you know what I mean? I went from campaign to campaign, took some, you know, did the usual stuff, kept playing my music and, you know, maybe smoking stuff I shouldn't have smoked when I was in high school and stuff.
I feel like listening to you, I mean, I kind of use the Breakfast Club model for understanding like who people were in high school.
Prescient.
And you seem like so far you're like three of the types rolled into one, you know?
I don't know how to respond. I love the movie though.
What? Where
I wasn't the jock. That's
all of them except that one.
Yes.
Trust is not cleverly shading words so that each separate audience can hear what it wants to hear, but saying plainly and simply what you mean and meaning what you say.
Even though they lost that campaign, Will ended up working with Bob Dole down the road. Don't worry, we'll get to that. For now, after high school, Will studied history and English at the University of Kansas, but he dropped out to play music in a rock band, which somehow landed him in London with a couple of buddies. And that is where an encounter with Charlton Heston, of all people, threw him back into politics.
These stories are funny. They're a blast. But we had a room. We had another guy from Boston named Andrew, who was a big Democrat. But they were volunteering for Neil Kinnock, who was the Labor Party guy at that point. I went down and tried to volunteer with David Owens, who later went on to be one of the negotiators for the Bosnian Accords. But he did not win that election. And he wouldn't hire me because I was an American. So the U.S. ambassador to England at that point was a guy named Charlie Price, who was a Kansas Cityan. And another friend of mine over there goes, well, he's an American. Why don't you just go talk to him? So I showed up there and said, this is what I want to do. And he's like, well, here's a guy's name. He works for Peter Brook, who is an MP in central London. And he goes, you know, if you work for them, the parties over here are very different. The parties are a lot stronger. It's not so candidate driven. You'll work for everybody. And I went down and with that letter from the U.S. ambassador, and they took me on as a volunteer, and I did a lot of work training. And at that same time, my day gig was working in a hotel a block from the U.S. embassy called 47 Park Street, which I think it's still there. It was one of the finest hotels, boutique hotels. It had great guests, Bob Geldof, you know, David Stockman, Chief Nielsen Bassi of Africa. I mean, it was just this high-end, the whole Canary Wharf project rented the upstairs. And Charlton Heston stayed there filming A Man for All Seasons, which later was recorded and broadcast many times on Turner Broadcasting Network. You can still see it. And I was the only American, so I took care of Mr. Heston's room service needs all the time. And at the end of it, he goes, well, what do you want? He goes, we're done here in a couple of weeks. I'll, you know, take 20 of your friends. You can have front row seats. What do you want? And I go, well, I want a letter of introduction to Bob Dole, who's going to run for president next year.
Wow.
So he wrote
That's what you wanted more than anything?
Yeah. And then he still gave me my 20 friends tickets to the show too, but he wrote me that letter, and that letter helped when I came back home to get an interview.
That is amazing, because you're in London, you're in England, and you're a guy from Kansas, and Bob Dole is back in Kansas, and it's that you've gone on this long journey to get this introduction into Kansas politics.
Yep.
So when you met Bob Dole, what happened?
Well, it's fun. I mean, the letter got me an interview with a gentleman by the name of Blunt, whose brother happened to be the Secretary of the State of Missouri. And about halfway through the interview, I realized that I'm interviewing for the boss of the job I thought I was interviewing for. So I had to totally reset this interview. It was like, I have no idea what's going on here, but I do know that we're talking about two different things. And he's like, I like you. Let's start.
Eventually, Will hopped over the state line to Missouri, where he ran two senatorial campaigns for John Ashcroft, the guy who would later become George W. Bush's attorney general. You may remember John Ashcroft as the guy who covered the partially nude statues in the Justice Department out of modesty.
I was the grassroots guy. Republican politics in Missouri didn't have very good grassroots up through Danforth. It was all called the long ball. It was all about TV and broadcast. and working through with Roy Blunt to start with when he ran and lost governor race against Webster, and then immediately switching to Kit Bond's campaign right then and doing his field rep for the whole state. That's really what I did. That's what I did with John Ashcroft, too. I helped him build his statewide organization in his first race and then again in his second.
John Ashcroft was a socially conservative politician, not the kind of guy you would imagine hanging out in Will's bookstore today. Not by a long shot. But is it really that simple?
He loved to play basketball. He loved to play tennis. He liked to ride his three-wheeler down on the farm. He was a pretty good guy, actually. I have a lot of very good memories of working with John Ashcroft. He was a good man. He was a rigid man, and he had very established and rigid opinions on a lot of stuff. But, you know, he was a human being who did stuff and was most of his... I still remember him in Iowa refusing to take a position on gay marriage. And that was really a big deal during the presidential race, that he did an exploratory race up there, and I was the Iowa coordinator for him.
What year are we talking about?
90, maybe?
Yeah, 1990. That is
90.
An early point to not take a stance on that.
Yeah, and it was very early, and be a Republican, and be coming from the spectrum in the party that he was. And he didn't believe personally that gay rights was something that was biblical in his thing, but he also did not take a public stand on it because, like, he wasn't enforcing his views, his very personal religious views, on other people in a consequential way. I mean, he was a man of contradictions, like almost, again, everybody is. You'll find people who are, they're not just cardboard caricatures that are distilled down to 30-second sound bites by both sides trying to define who they are. They're complex people with a broad range of pressures and ideas of their own. You know, and it's strange. The world is often, we have these images of what the world is. And we're sitting in our rooms and we're talking to people who are of, if not like mine, we all agree on what the questions are as opposed to what necessarily the answers are. And once you get out of that room, you quite often figure out that not only are those answers not doing what you thought they were, those weren't even the questions to start with. But you are there to change. I mean, ultimately, you're there to change. You're the better yourself and your family. But politics, by its very nature, should be a thing in which we're trying to better the whole, not just ourselves. And I think that may be part of the crux of the current disjunct between voters and what the American people keep polling they want and what Washington seems to be doing.
And this is how Will, the bookstore owner, came to be. After 27 years working in GOP politics, Will Leatham was having a drink with a friend at Gilhooly's, a little Irish dive bar with pool tables, on the block where his bookstore is now.
And we're just like, yeah, God, wouldn't it be great to just go someplace and read books and have talk about the stuff we want to talk about? And within a month, we had the keys to the building and were racing to get open in our first location.
What year is this?
97. There were 12 used bookstores within a few miles of there when we opened. We deliberately raced to open on November 19th, which was the anniversary of when Sylvia Beach opened Shakespeare and Company in Paris. And John and I deliberately wanted her juju because she was the home. That's where Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Picasso and Gertrude Stein and these folks came to hang out.
So you wanted a bookstore for writers, partly.
That was part of the original plan. We wanted a place where artists came, the good artists that were serious about what they were doing. Good is a weird term. I didn't mean to use that.
I forgive you.
Yeah, indicting anybody's quality of their work, but people who were serious about what they were trying to do and conscious of it and pursuing it with a lot of passion and physical commitment. We wanted a place for that.
What surprised you about the bookstore business? I mean, there had to be pieces of that business that surprised you, making such a big shift.
That there's a waste stream.
What do you mean?
In every business, there's a waste stream, and there just gets to be books that you can't sell, either because nobody will read them and not because of the content, just because it's just, it's times come and gone. It's dated, it's conditioned, it's stuff like that. I still remember Tom, my current partner, talking about the day he first threw a book away into a trash can and how weird it made him feel to actually get, because I mean, literature and books, there's a certain kind of a secular idolatry to them. They can contain some of the most important stuff about our human condition and our takes on it. And it, the fact that you have to get rid of some of this stuff, you can't have everything. And behind every Barnes & Noble and library in America is a giant green dumpster where stuff goes. And all of them are trying to give them to places. I mean, we go through times where we're donating stuff we can't use. And Goodwill's like, we can't take anymore. We're done. You don't bring them in right now. That was the biggest shock, actually. It's weird, is that you have to throw away books occasionally. They have to be repurposed and refed back into the stream through recycling or whatever.
How has the bookstore changed you over the years?
It's made me more comfortable to be myself. It's taught me that a lot of the results that when I was involved in politics, I was hoping to see occur, and I thought we were all working towards, were contrary to what was actually happening in the applied side of it with normal everyday people who were walking in the door. So, I mean, it's real easy to say, you know, you teach a person, you give a person a fish, and they don't, you know, and you teach them to fish, and they'll feed themselves. Right? Whatever. I'm just going to tell you, it's not that simple. It's never that simple. Policy-wise, there is a significant and solid strain in government at all levels to try and solve problems. Now, that butts up against trying to make money and ideology and all kinds of other things, but it's still there. But seeing it applied, I mean, I own a business. It's the first time I'd owned a business, and it's a lot different than it looks in the ivory tower of an office, a Senate office building at the top of a building and in D.C. than it is here.
As hard as we try to map out our lives in a way that makes total sense, random things are going to happen. Maybe a kid at school starts a fight that ignites a lifelong passion, or we run into Charlton Heston because, of course we do. Maybe a conversation with a friend gives us an unshakable idea that sends us in a new direction, but who we are deep down probably does not change all that much. And so it is for Will Leatham, the slicked-back political consultant he used to be and the bohemian bookstore owner he is now, have a lot in common.
You know, most people who start in politics may be getting rid of and controlling for some of the crazier elements that seek TV time, but most people behind the scenes are trying to figure out a way to better their own lives, obviously with a good job that has upward potential, but also you're trying to make a difference in your culture. And that's across all of the lines. Again, I think the system has become much more shrill in the last decade and a half, and that was part of my decision to step back. I didn't want to be a part of. It's always been the Marcus of Queensberry rules, and it was a fight, but now it's unlimited cage fighting, and I'm a 52-year-old man with a 10-year-old kid, and I'm not so excited about just throwing as much mud and hitting people as hard as you can possibly hit them anymore. I'd much rather work on the issues.
So shaping the culture you live in, is so that, would you call that the drive behind your political career as well as your book peddling career?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, you pursue a curious mind and somebody who wants to be, who's not just completely introverted and wants to be active and have a role in your community or a role on a bigger stage. You're trying to shape it. You're trying to figure out the best possible information by putting things into your head, reading well, listening well, looking at great art, having really brilliant conversations with very smart other people who may or may not agree with you. And then, you know, you're trying to build either legislation or write a great play or a brilliant song that touches somebody or a painting that somebody cannot walk by without looking at. It's all dealing with the human condition in a proactive way.
Why do you do it?
Love, period.
Love,
out and out.
Period.
Love it.
This episode of Midwesternish was produced by Matt Hodapp and Jen Chen. Sylvia Maria Gross is our editor. You can subscribe to this podcast on NPR One or wherever you generally do that kind of thing. If you like this podcast and want to hear more stories like these, you can also check out Central Standard, a daily show that I host on Kansas City's public radio station, KCUR 89.3. Head to kcur.org if you want to check it out. I'm Gina Kaufman. Thanks for listening.